So that way, now recording is on, so all of our opinions and thoughts will be remembered by posterity for generations and generations, so be careful at every... No, I'm joking. No one's viewing this. I mean, it'll be on YouTube, but we'll see how many people view it. So anyway, welcome, everyone. We are in our second shiur of learning Makos together. And last week, we learned Beis Amin Aleph. We did 2A, if you're following it in the art scroll. And now, naturally, we are on Beis Amin Beis. And God willing, by the end of tonight, not only would have we accomplished learning an Amud of Gemara, but we would have completed our first daf of a Gemara together, both sides of the page. So a huge accomplishment, God willing. But before we jump into the Gemara, there were a few questions that some of you asked last week that I wanted to look a little bit more into so I could give you an answer. So two questions that stuck out to me in particular that I think required more analysis. One was the central question that should strike anybody when we talk about Edim Zomimin, about conspiring witnesses, which is, why is it when we say the Hebrew term is kasher zomam, when they attempt, let's say, to give someone capital punishment, then they get capital punishment if they are found to be Edim Zomimin. But if they succeed, kasher asa, they actually completed the deed that someone was killed based on their words, someone was put to death, then they are not put to death when they are found guilty for being perjurious witnesses. So the question is, it seems backwards. I would say if they succeed in having someone die based on their words, then that's when they should be put to death. If they only attempted, then give them something else. So what is the logic in that? So what I did was I went to the Pasuk and I took out my trusty Mikros Gedolos, and the Ramban actually has a very helpful comment on this Pasuk. So the Pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, 19:19. So the Ramban comments are basically our question. So he says as follows, theologically, Aval im narag Ruvain, nasha shahaya emes koasher idolav harishonim. If Ruvain gets put to death, now this came up, those are with us for Thursday morning, Sharag Mul, when we talked about theology and why good things happen to bad people, theodicy questions. We said that somebody could die because God wants them to die for whatever reason. It could be their time, it could be due to their sins, but if God wants someone to die on earth, that's not license for me to be the murderer. But it's not as bad in God's books as if I went in and killed somebody who God did not decree it was their time to die. So what's happening here, the Ramban says, is kiba vono mace, that when this person, the defendant, is put to death, when the witnesses succeed, kasher asa, in having the based in based on their false testimony, bring this person to death. Lo yazvenu Hashem biyadam. If this person actually, in God's accounting book, was righteous and was fully innocent and did not deserve to die, God would have ensured that these witnesses were found to be Edim Zomimin prior to the verdict being fulfilled and having him be executed. So the reason God declared that there should be a more severe punishment for conspiring witnesses when they do not succeed is because if they do succeed, then it's still very bad, but then the indication is that that person really was meant to be put to death by Beis Din. Okay, Toby, looks like you got a question.
I am so not convinced. And I don't see how this is different than God's will for any other punishment. If a person actually received the lashes, let's say. But so the Edim Zomimim still can get the lashes, right? So why don't you just say, well, God wanted them to get the lashes, so what, not so bad, the Edim Zomimim should get something less. The logic just doesn't...
Right. I guess what it teaches us is that if you want to kill somebody, make sure you succeed. That's the lesson. No, I'm just kidding. Don't. That's not halakha l'maisa. But no, I understand. It's basically, like I said in the first class, we're not going to find a fully satisfactory answer to this. But there you go. There's an attempt from the Ramban. Not in Shaar HaGmul, in his commentary on the Torah. But as you can see, I guess you don't like his theology in general.
Generally, I do like the Ramban. This is just a deviation.
Jeremy.
Well, Rabbi, I think something that you mentioned last week, which resonated with me, is kind of there. It was almost like a clearing of accounts. Like there was someone sentenced to death. There was a death sentence that was issued. Someone, satisfied that account, whether it was the right person or not. And so, you know, the lashes or whatever the punishment for the Eina Zomamin would be. That's here on earth. And rather than creating a second, account for a death, that's not within the purview of the Beit Din. And that's within Hashem's purview. So there's one account that's been filled. And if we got it wrong here, that's the way that it went. But, it's not for us to create a second account. That was sort of what I took from what you said last week.
Yes, so Jeremy, thanks for bringing that back up. So Rav Elchanan Wasserman said that once Beis Din gives a verdict, it has to go somewhere. So if it's not going to the defendant, now that the defendant has been exonerated, then it has to go to, it should go to the witnesses who attempted, who basically created that verdict to begin with. But they're not mutually exclusive. The Ramban is tackling the question from a theological standpoint. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman's point, which Jeremy, you're bringing back to our attention, was tackling it from a legalistic standpoint, from the mechanics of how halacha works. But anyway, again, this is not, there's no clear-cut answer that's going to make everyone say, oh, that's what I've been missing this whole time. At least not that I found. If anyone discovers a really airtight answer, you'll let me know. That was question number one that we left off with. The second question that we had, and this one actually was the question that Toby pointed out toward the end, is we mentioned that there are three, and this is important for Chazara, there are three important points in time on the timeline that we have to keep in mind. There is the testimony of the witnesses prior to Beis Din giving a verdict. Then there's Beis Din giving the verdict, that's called Gemar Din. And then there's the Beis Din fulfilling, manifesting the verdict by executing the person, by giving them malchus, by giving them lashes. So that's important because in that timeline, right, we say kasher zaman velo kasher asa. If they only conspired and the verdict was already given, if only when the verdict is given, but before they actually fulfill the verdict physically, in actuality, that's the window of opportunity that the witnesses could become Edom Zomamin. Now, here's the thing, though. Toby pointed out, wait, when it comes to a monetary case, now Zadie's here with us, my grandfather's here, and we had a long discussion during the week about it, but suffice to say, if I testify that Reuven owed Shimon money, and then the Beis Din hears me out, and my fellow witness needs to be two witnesses, and therefore, and Reuven pays Shimon based on my false testimony, Shimon could actually return that money to Reuven after I'm found to be a false witness. So there really is no third point in time, right? Usually in the timeline, once Malchus is given, once the death penalty is given, it can't be taken back. You know, you could say, I'm sorry for giving you Malchus. I'm sorry. You can't really say sorry to someone once you give them capital punishment. That it's a little hard to do that. So those are things that are irreversible. And therefore, Tosfos on Dalid Amid Beis in Bava Basra. It's not in our Gemaras, but if you happen to have a Gemara Bava Basra with you, it's on Dalid Amid Beis 4b over there. That Tosfos gives two reasons why, when it comes to money, the witnesses could become Edom Zomamin at any point. There's no kasher asa. There's no final action that closes off the witnesses from the possibility of becoming Edom Zomamin. So one reason is, the first answer given in Tosos is Toby's point. V'lo shayach b'momem kasher zaman v'lo kasher asa, de'efsher b'chazara, because Once the witnesses are found to be false, the money could be returned. So there's no kasher usa. It's reversible. So Adam Zomen in a monetary dispute, they could always be found as Adam Zomen at any point later on. It could be years later. And then the second reason that we didn't, no one suggested last time, it's a little bit more obscure, is Degabe Mamon Onshin Min Hadin. So we talked about in the Gemara last week, we discussed a Kal V'Chomer. We said, wait a minute, why can't I make a Kal V'Chomer? The Kal V'Chomer is that if witnesses conspire to give someone the death penalty, they get put to death. Kal V'Chomer, if they succeed in having someone be given the death penalty, certainly they should be put to death. And we said, you can't make a Kal V'Chomer like that. And then we left it as that, as a black box. I actually never explained it, and no one ever held me accountable for that. So we're circling back now. Now, why is it that I can't make a Kal V'Chomer like that? Again, I don't have a good translation for Kal V'Chomer, a fortiori, whatever you want to call it, but we get it in context. The reason is because there's a principle in halacha, ein onshin min hadin, that we do not use Kal V'Chomers to punish somebody. We do not use Kal V'Chomers to punish somebody when it comes. So now here's the thing. What kind of punishments do I not say ein onshin min hadin? Tosa suggests maybe when it comes to malchus, when it comes to death penalties, we don't do Kal V'Chomers. But when it comes to monetary law, which is it's all within the purview, the general laws and the zik and the laws of damages, torts, but it's its own subunit within that, within law. So maybe we say onshin min hadin when it comes to monetary law. So if I can use a Kal V'Chomer when it comes to monetary law, then I could apply a Kal V'Chomer. Okay, so maybe money, we don't consider money reversible. Once the money's given, that's the end. Kasher Asa, the deed has been done. Really, the witnesses should now be in Kasher Asa territory, not a Kasher Zamam territory. They didn't just conspire, they succeeded. But we can make a Kal V'Chomer that witnesses who conspired become Adam Zomen, Kal V'Chomer, witnesses that succeed in making Reuven pay Shimon, they also can become Adam Zomen. Why? Because Kal V'Chomers can be used in monetary cases, but they cannot be used in capital cases. Now, here's the circular reasoning. Is this really a second answer, or is this a build off the first answer? Maybe the reason that we say that Ein Onshin Min Hadin for capital punishment is because it's not reversible. But for money, which is reversible, one could say, we'll make a Kal V'Chomer. Worst comes to worst, we find out our Kal V'Chomer was faulty down the line. Someone disproved the logic of my Kal V'Chomer. He'll pay the money back in the end of the day. But capital punishment, once someone's put to death, you can't reverse that. I mean, unless, you know, you're one of these rabbis in some of the Agadas and Agadata portions in the Gemara that they can revive each other. That's the story of Purim. That's coming up. You know, you have two rabbis that were eating together. One of them got really drunk. He kills the other one. And then he just does chias amesim and revives him on the spot. So most people can't do that. I'm not capable. They don't teach me how to do that in smicha. I wish. That'd be really cool. But that is the case. Judge.
So, question.
Yes.
Dealing with monetary situations, the Adam Zomimim wound up having to pay the injured party, the original injured party.
By injured party, you mean the person claiming owed someone else money.
Right. Yes. But there's another victim. Mm-hmm. The ones that they're trying to pin us on improperly. What remedy is there for him as being a victim of the Adam Zomimim directly?
Wait, so who's the second?
In other words, the Zomims come disqualify witnesses that were improperly stating that this person owed the money. Mm-hmm. They are now determined to be false.
Yeah.
But the person that they tried to pin it on, it doesn't pay, but it's still a victim of being put in that situation. What happens to him?
Well,
what What can he get out of it?
Well, it's interesting that you portray him as a victim, because I would have actually assumed that he was in on it with the witnesses the whole time.
Because that's a possibility.
Otherwise, yeah. I, you know, just imagine how this would play out. If he really wasn't owed, if he didn't deserve the money, he should have piped up and said that. And actually, there's something called a Kenyan Odisa, that if I, it means, it's from the word hoda, to admit. If I admit that I owe somebody money, then that takes effect. That's actually very relevant for estate law, for Jewish estate law, that someone could use a Kenyan Odisa and say, I owe my daughter money, and that obligates the sons from the estate to pay their sister from there as well. So there's a lot to discuss there, but it's interesting that you see him as the victim. I actually kind of viewed him as one of the conspirators, or that he may have even hired those witnesses to lie on his behalf. So there is what to discuss there. It's a good point. Rabbi? Anyway, this is all in introduction, and this is all handling questions from last time, which are really fundamental and important too, because we're going to talk about Ein Zomen for a while, for next good number of weeks. So I really wanted to take the time to answer these fundamental questions, Rabbi? Which no doubt will come up. But we'll take Phyllis's point, and then we'll move on to the Gemara for tonight.
So you said something about a good explanation for Kal Vachomer. It stands to reason?
Well, there's different logical... Okay, I mean, there's different logical devices. Stands to reason is a good formulation. I'll try that one. We're going to bring another Kal Vachomer in. Okay, so if I can orient you again, if you are using Sepharia, then I can't really tell you what line we're on, because it doesn't have the Tzuras Adath. It doesn't have the traditional format of the Gemara. But if you are using, if you're looking in the actual text of the Gemara, we are at the two dots, four lines down from the top of Beis on the Beis of 2b. And if you're in the Art Scroll, I imagine you're on the 2b1a, whatever it is, the first page, where you should be just three lines from the top. Okay. All right. So last time, remember in our Mishnah, we said there are two exceptions to the rule of Ein Zomen. Ein Zomen, generally, they get the punishment that they tried to mete out, that they falsely accused the defendant of. But we said if they falsely accuse, they falsely claim that somebody was a Ben Grusha or Ben Chalutza, that someone was a Chalau, he was lost his kahuna status, then we do not make the witnesses into Chalalim. They don't lose their kahuna status if they were Kohanim. Why? Well, we learned lo velo lizaro. It says in the Pasuk that you should do to him. So we say, to him, to the witnesses, not to their children. You can't give them a verdict that would affect their children as well. Now we're going to explore the second part of the Mishnah, which is, why is it when two witnesses claim that Reuven inadvertently killed Shimon, he killed Shimon b'shogeg while they're out in the forest, he accidentally, the axe slipped out and embedded himself in Shimon's head, and therefore Reuven is partially guilty. He didn't deliberately murder Shimon, but it wasn't an ones either. It wasn't like it was beyond his capability to be careful and not to do that. He could have checked the axe, been careful. There are precautions he could have taken. That's what we assume. So
negligent homicide.
What? What's the term?
Negligent homicide.
Oh, okay, great. So I'm glad we got some attorneys over here. So it's negligent homicide. That's the term here. So therefore, why is it, I would think, the witnesses should go to Gullus. They should go to one of the cities of refuge, just like the defendant would have had to go to a city of refuge and live out his life until the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, died. That's the rule. So why do the witnesses not have to go into exile, even though they intended to make the defendant go into exile?
Because nobody wants to kill them.
What was that?
There are no relatives of a deceased who want to kill them.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying there's no function. The whole function of the city of refuge is that they are seeking refuge from the relatives, but they didn't murder anyone. That's a good point. I don't have a good answer to that, but that's a good point. All right, minahani mili. So what's the deal? Where do we know this from, that they don't have to go to exile? Amar Reish Lagish, Amar Kra, just like Gezeiras HaKasav, another similar to Lov Lo Lazaro. We're going to look into the pasuk, into the verse, and derive it from there. Hu Yanus El Achas HaArim, Hu Velo Zomamin. It says he will flee to one of the cities of refuge, he to the exclusion of Adam Zomamin. That's answer number one. Pretty straightforward. Answer number two, though, brings back in a Kal V'Chomer, and it's not so straightforward. Rabbi Yochanan Omer, Kal V'Chomer. Phyllis, what was your translation? It stands to reason. So the rule is, when someone inadvertently kills somebody, negligent homicide, they go to exile. But someone who deliberately murders somebody, so we're going to learn about this later in Makos, but if they get warned not to do it, and there's two witnesses, and he says, I know I'm going to be punished for doing, but I'm going to murder him anyway, then we put him to death. But absent a lot of details that need to line up perfectly, someone who kills B'mezid, who kills deliberately, he does not go to a city of refuge. A city of refuge is only for people who kill inadvertently. So here's the Kal V'Chomer. Umahu sha'asa ma'isa b'mezid eno gola, hein shelo asa ma'isa b'mezid eno din shelo yiglu. So if a person kills someone inadvertently, someone murders, he doesn't go to Gullus, he doesn't go to exile. Certainly, witnesses who they did something bad deliberately, but they didn't do a maisa, they didn't perform an action, they just used words. So, if I were to rate how terrible a sin is, I would say committing a physical action is worse than just using your words to do something wrong. So if someone who murders somebody doesn't go to the city of refuge for doing it deliberately, someone who uses their words sinfully, maliciously, and deliberately also shouldn't have to go to exile. Well, there's a big hole in this logic over here, the Gemara retorts. The Gemara says, "Binosenes lo dinhu. Who shall us a mice of amazed lo ligli? Why is it that a person who murders someone in cold blood doesn't go to the city of refuge? It's not for his benefit that he doesn't go to the city of refuge. Kihechi dvolti havale kapara, and this is going to answer hopefully Zadie's question, which is that when you go into a city of refuge and you have to live your life out there, it's not simply to protect you from the Goli Hadam, from the Avengers, not the comic books, but the Avengers of blood, the relatives who want to avenge the blood of their family member that was killed. But living in the city of refuge, uprooting yourself from your life and moving into one of the Levite cities, that is a kapara that's meant to be an atonement by living in those cities for all of those years. So why the person who murders deliberately, he doesn't have the schus. He doesn't get the merit of going to a city to do tshuva, to atone for his sin. We don't give him the option to do that. It's to punish him. We don't want to give him that easy way out to atone for his sin by going to the city of refuge. But maybe I would say in Zomen, they also acted maliciously, deliberately, but they didn't do a maisa. They didn't do a malicious action. They only use malicious words, so they're not as bad as that person. So maybe I would say that Adam Zomamin, that falsely accused someone of negligent homicide, maybe they should go to a city of refuge because they're pretty bad, but they're not as bad as a deliberate murderer. They're a rung lower, so maybe they should go to a city of refuge so they could get a kapara, so they could get an atonement. So the whole Kal V'Chomer falls apart. So now, how do we know that Aim Zomen don't go to Gullus? I actually have a very great counter Kal V'Chomer that they ought to go into exile because they're not as bad as a deliberate murderer. Therefore, El Mechaverta Kidereish Lakish. Rather, the Gemara has to revert back, similar to what we did before. The first answer makes more sense. What's the first answer? Reish Lakish said, we simply derive it from the verse. Hu velo zomamin. It says, hu yanus, he in the singular, will flee to the city of refuge. And we derive from there, him to the exception of Adam Zomerman, just like Lo Vilo Lazaro, him to the exception of his children. So here, him to the exception of Adam Zoma. It's a similar kind of point that's being made. End of that section. Any questions to understand that passage in the Gemara, Toby?
Isn't there an easier way to understand it? I mean, the person who killed Beshogeg did it Beshogeg. There's no such thing as an Adam Zoma meme by mistake. That's always intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's going to be some kind of parallel between the crimes and the punishments, it shouldn't be. I mean, it makes sense that you wouldn't let the Adam Zoma meme go there, because what they did, whether it was physical or not, was clearly intentional. And whatever they're going to suffer, I mean, they're going to suffer something after the other person goes off into exile. He's going to suffer something, right? He's going to get lashes.
Right. So these witnesses will get lashes. They'll get 39 lashes because they're not going to Gullus. That's what we established from the Mishnah. Right. But so you're right. On the one hand, they're very similar to someone who commits a deliberate murder because they are acting deliberately.
Right.
But on the other hand,
that's what a crime is always about, intent.
Well, that at least in Jewish law, intention is part of it, but it's also the severity of the action as well. Mm-hmm. That's also something that's taken into account. So it's possible that on the one hand, the witnesses are like a deliberate murderer in the fact that they act deliberately. But the thing is, their actual crime, you know, for instance, I deliberately murder somebody, and I can deliberately shoplift. There's a difference. So there's the nature of the crime that's committed as well, not just the intention. But if you have a very severe crime coupled with very bad intentions, that will probably lead you to very bad results. So that's the game that's being played over here. They didn't do something as severe as murder, yet they're similar that they also had that they had malicious intent. So that's the cheshbon. That's what the Gemara is trying to parse out here. Okay. Well, that brings down a quarter way of the Amud. We still got ways to go. Now here's the thing. We kind of just took this for granted last time. Last time we learned, as Toby just brought up again, that when witnesses don't go to exile and they don't become disqualified from kahuna, what happens? They get malchus. They get lashes. Mehechi tesi. Where do we learn that from? Where do we come up with malchus, with lashes, as the generic punishment for someone who we can't give the specific crime, the specific punishment that they tried to accuse someone else of committing? So here is the source for malchus serving as a generic punishment for false witnesses. Amar Ula, remez la'edim zomim min ha-Torah minayin. Where can I find a hint in the Torah to the concept of Adam Zomerman? The Gemara interjects, Remez Adam Zomerman, Baksiv, Vasiz Mukasher Zamam. What do you mean a hint in the Torah, Adam Zomerman? I have an explicit pasuk. The verse states explicitly, Vasizim lo kasher Zamam. It's an explicit verse that talks about Adam Zomerman. What do you mean a hint in the Torah? Ela Remez Adam Zomerman, Shalokim min haTorah minayin. Rather, where do I know in the Torah a source that Adam Zomerman could get malchus, that they could get lashes if we can't give them the punishment that they sought to mete out? So we need to find a source for. How do we know that they get malchus as the default punishment that we default on? Dichsiv, as it says in the pasuk, says in the verse in also in Devarim, Vetziku es hatzadik v'rashiu es harasha v'haya in ben hakos harasha. So when they will find, when they'll exonerate the innocent party and they find the guilty party guilty, the guilty party will get lashes. Wait a minute. You know, if you and I have a monetary dispute and it turns out that I was wrong in the end and really I owe you money and that's the end, I don't get malchus for that. Why should I get malchus just because I lost the case? That doesn't make any sense. So Mishumet Stiles and Cyber Shius are Russia, but Ben Akosa Russia. What the guilty party, he automatically gets Malkus for losing a case because he lost a monetary dispute in court. That makes absolutely no sense. Ela Adam Shur Shu as a tzaddik. Rather, what's this referring to? This pasuk is referring to Adam Zoman. Witnesses that they claim that a tzaddik is a Rasha, that the innocent is guilty. Vasu Adam Akharini, and then a second pair of witnesses come. Vetstiko as a tzaddik meikara. The Shavin Lahani Rashayim. They exonerate the person who's really innocent. They prove that correct, that he actually is innocent. They confirm that. And then they prove that they testify that the first pair of witnesses were false witnesses. Then, Vehayim ben Hakosa Rasha. Then we give Malkus to, who are the Rashayim now? The Rashayim are referring to the Adam Zoman. Those are the wicked people. The Adam Zoman, the false witnesses, those are the people who get Malkus. Every time someone loses a case in court, you know, if for all our attorneys over here, imagine every time, you know, the client that you're working for, you lose the case. And so the client now has to get Malkus because he lost the case. That'd be absurd. Rather, what this is referring to is, it's referring to the Adam Zomimin who tried to claim that the tzaddik was a Rasha, but in fact they were duplicitous, they were malicious, they lied, and therefore they get Malkus. That's the.
Do we know who this is referring to? Any particular people in the Torah that this is referring to?
Well, that's the whole point. It sounds very generic. It sounds like it could be referring to a whole host of cases. And that's why the Gemara asked, what do you mean? Everyone gets Malkus every time they lose a case? The point is, it's referring to Adam Zoman.
That's what the Torah
teaches us. But then the Gemara asks, just we're almost at the end of this section here, but typically in Losana, wait a minute, I can find you a much better source. Trivia time, right? I'm told that there's a trivia night being made for our shul. Yep. I think it's Judy Kahn and Dina, right? Judy and Dina are working on
Dina Berger.
Mm-hmm. Right, Dina Berger. So they asked me for a trivia question. Here's a trivia question for everyone. Yep. What is the ninth commandment in the Ten Commandments? What is the ninth commandment in the Ten Commandments? You can Google it if you want.
Ninth commandment in the Ten.
False witness.
Isn't that false witnesses?
Very good. That's Paul cool. And Jenny got it. Losana v'recha id shaker. That you shouldn't be a false witness. Oh, wait a minute. Why do I have to start getting to all this, all these Adam Zoman stuff? Wait a minute. The Ten Commandments. The Ninth Commandment says, don't be a false witness. Losana v'recha id shaker. You were asked, the tape claim you losana. You want a source, a catch-all source for all false witnesses, even if they don't qualify as Adam Zomerman? Because remember, it's Adi Sheker. Adam Zoman is a specific kind of false witness. But there's also a general prohibition of being a false witness, which we learn from the Ten Commandments, from Losana v'recha id shaker. So wait a minute. Why do I need to go to this whole drush of Hayim Ben Akosa Russia? Let me just invoke the Ninth Commandment as the source for giving Malkus or giving lashes to anyone who violates the prohibition of bearing false witnesses. So the answer is, this is a very important concept to know in Shas in general. Mishum dahavi lav she'en bo maisa, v'lechol lav she'en bo maisa ein lo ken lav, because we have a principle that when someone commits a sin, but the sin is not an action, it's words, it's passively committing a sin, or you're doing it verbally, but you're not committing an actual bona fide physical action, a deed, then you can't get Malkus for it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually very logical, because if you didn't do something physical, you're not going to get a physical punishment. Malkus is corporal punishment. That's a physical punishment. So if you did not commit a physical sin, you're not going to get a physical punishment for that sin. So Losana, all I know from Losana is that there, you know, it's still very bad. You know, you're not allowed to do something that's a sin, but it's not a sin that would incur Malkus if all I had was the pasuk of the ninth commandment of Losana v'recha id shaker. But comes along this drasha of Ahayim bin Hakos HaRasha, comes along this whole entire exposition that we just gave from this other pasuk to teach us that even though I would think Losana v'recha id shaker would not be enough of a basis to give Malkus to false witnesses, comes along this pasuk and tells me Losana is able to give false witnesses malchus. So any witnesses that don't qualify for Hazama, they're not Edom Zomimen for whatever reason, they're just regular, ordinary Edei Sheker, perjurious witnesses, they will get malchus, even though that's the chiddush, that's the novelty of the rule. Even though all they did was speak words, they didn't do any action, nothing physical, nothing tangible, but they get malchus for it nonetheless. That's what we learn from these verses. Okay. This part was like a little bit more technical.
Talking about witnesses, I assume that you need two witnesses in a Beis Din. One witness does not make a case.
So one witness, well, for these kind of purposes, one witness could be helpful. We have a principle. So here would be a case, like in a monetary dispute, Reuven claims that Shimon owes him money. So if Reuven can procure only one witness to substantiate his claim, he won't be able to take the money from Shimon on the basis of one witness. But what he could do is he could be mechayev, he can obligate Shimon to take a shvua, to take an oath that he does not owe Reuven money. So one witness is not sufficient to win the case, but it could be instrumental, because if Shimon says, you know what, I'm not going to hold a sefer Torah and make a false oath while holding it, it's a very serious sin. You're holding a Torah scroll and you swear in the name of God that something happened and you're swearing falsely. Well, I mean, there's another one of the Ten Commandments, right? So that's what one witness could accomplish. Jenny.
Hi, my husband actually had a question, so I just want to give him appropriate credit. What if the conspiring witnesses are found to, of course, you know, they lied, they're false, but their testimony happened to be true? Like, they were wrong, they didn't actually see whatever, they said Shimon owns Reuven $100 or whatever it is. They were lying, they didn't actually see it happen, blah, blah, blah. But Shimon actually did take Reuven's money and owes him money. What happened? Is that still considered a conspiring witness if they're found to have lied, but if they didn't distort the truth, if you know
yes.
what I mean?
Yes, I believe so. So I believe that's a very good question. And I believe they do actually get the punishment nonetheless, because their disqualification isn't, this is on Basim and Av, we touched on it briefly. When the second pair of witnesses come in, they don't say Reuven and that the first pair are lying. They say they were with us. Imano hayisim b'makom ploni. They were with us on this day in this place. So what they're doing is they're not just simply saying that the first pair are deceitful, that they are lying, but they're saying that they don't even qualify to be in the room right now giving any testimony. They couldn't possibly know one way or the other. So I believe they would get the punishment nonetheless. Happens to be that they may have been right in the end of the day, but their testimony was still that of being Edom Zomimen. I believe that is the din, but you know what? Let me check on that. All right.
That kind of goes to Judd's question too. No, that's why they don't actually compensate the person that they're calling a liar, because it has nothing to do with him. This is them being punished for being false witnesses, not necessarily them for causing him harm.
Right, it could relate back to that. Okay, that's a good connection, David. Okay, so let's soldier forward a little bit. We have a little under 20 minutes, and we're halfway through the Yamid. So, and I'm sure some of the material we're about to cover also, I think we'll have some questions on that. There's some good stuff here. I mean, it's all good stuff. All right, Tana Rabbanan. So here's a Brisa now. So for those of us who are learning for the first time, so Mishnayos are the what we saw at the beginning. Those are Taniyitic statements, and the Gemara is Amorayim, which are about 300 years later or so. And then you have Brisos, which are kind of like apocryphal Mishnayos. They're also from Tanayim, but they're not codified in the same way that the Mishnah is. The Mishnah is dispositive; it's authoritative. Brisos also carry authority, but because they were not codified into the Mishnah, if a Brisa and a Mishnah are at odds with each other, then the Mishnah trumps the Brisa. But sometimes the Brisa will just have supplemental information that doesn't contradict the Mishnah, but adds on to what the Mishnah says. And that's going to be the case here in this Brisa. Tanur Rabbanan, Dal Dvar Nemer Be'edim Zomen. There are four four exceptions to the rules of Eidim Zomen. Some of them, hopefully, we are familiar with by now. Einas and Ben Grusha u Ben Chalutza, that they do not become disqualified Kohanim if they made that claim. Vein Gon Lari Mikla, they do not go to exile. Those were the two cases in our Mishnah. Now the Bryce is going to tell us two to three more cases. Vein Mishalman Esa Kofer, they do not pay Kofer. What is Kofer? Very briefly, let's say I own an ox. I own a cow or an ox named Bessie. Bessie gores a fellow cow, another cow. This happens three times. And So then the shor, the ox, gets established as a shor hamuad. This is a dangerous, violent ox. And I now need to be very careful about locking it up at night and not letting it roam freely in the pastures, murdering other oxen. Well, I was negligent. I did not lock up good old Bessie. I wanted her to be out there in the fields, all free and happy. And what happened as a result is that Bessie went ahead, and this time she didn't just gore a I know it's the oxen that have the horns, not the cows, I think. Yeah, right? Cows don't have horns, just the oxen. So the ox goes ahead and gores not an animal, but a human being, God forbid. So then not only, first of all, poor old Bessie is gonna face capital punishment. And on top of Bessie being executed, I have to pay what's called kofar. Kofar is, from the Lashon, we're going to learn soon, of kapara, of atonement. I have to atone for this person that got killed by my property, and therefore I pay a payment called kofar. We'll elaborate on that soon, but that's just the basics. The Eidim Karmbevet Ivri, and then the fourth exception, the Eidim Zomen, they do not have to pay kofar. That's why we bring that up. And then the fourth exception is Ve'enim Karim Be'evet Ivri. They do not get sold as a Jewish slave. Now, when would someone get sold as a Jewish slave? When, let's say, they owe somebody money and they can't make the payment. So then they get sold temporarily into servitude in order so that then the funds will pay back whoever they owe money to. So witnesses who claim that somebody owes someone money and that person would have to become an Evet Ivri, the witnesses, when they're proven false, they would not be sold into slavery instead. And then one more exception to the rule, which Rabbi Akiva adds on, Mishum Rabbi Akiva Amru, Af e Mishalman al pi atzman, that if they admit to being false witnesses in another court, they will absolve themselves from the payment. Now that one we're going to have a lot of questions about, but we'll elaborate on them soon. So now those are the five exceptions to the rule. Now we'd only have two exceptions. Now we've got a whopping five exceptions. And now the Gemara is going to explain the basis for all five exceptions. The good news is the first two exceptions will go by really quickly because we already learned them. Einas and Ben Grusha u Ben Chalutza. What's the source for that? Kida Amran, like we said already. Lo v'lo Lazaro, they get punished, not their children. Therefore, they can't get disqualified from Kahuna. The Ein Golan La'arei Miklat, why do the false witnesses not go to the city of refuge? Why don't they go into exile? Also, Kina Amran, like we just learned earlier tonight, we say, who? Velo Zomamin. He goes to exile, but not Eidim Zomamin. False witnesses would not go to exile. Now, we're going to have to elaborate because we have the other three, which are new exceptions. So exception number three. The Amish Shalman Es HaKofer. And the witnesses do not have to pay kofar if they accuse somebody of their ox murdering, killing a human being. Now, why do they not pay kofar? Well, if kofar was a standard payment, I would think they really should pay that amount of money. But the thing is, kasavri kufra kapara bahani lav b'nei kapara ninhu. Because what is kofar? Kofar is a lashon. It comes from the word kapara, an atonement. The idea is that when my ox murders somebody and I should have known that I was going to murder somebody, really, I should be put to death. Based in, because of my negligence, they ought to be executing me, not my poor cow, or me and my cow. But the cow is put to death instead of myself. This is very much like the idea of a karban, of a sacrifice. That's what Ramban says, that when someone brings a sacrifice to the temple, a sin offering, they're supposed to think to themselves, really, I should be on that altar right now, suffering and dying for my sin, but I make a sacrifice instead. So the witnesses Their ox didn't kill anybody. If it was monetary compensation, that, then they would have to pay. But since the covert payment is to achieve an atonement for me being negligent on my ox, these witnesses, as far as we know, they don't own an ox that they were warned about three times that then went ahead and murdered somebody. So they have nothing to atone for. So why would they pay anything? If it was a compensation, they would pay. But this isn't a compensation. This is to achieve atonement. They have to atone for their sins of being false witnesses, but that's not a kofar payment. A kofar payment is very specific for atoning for when your ox kills somebody. So that's why they don't pay kofar in this case.
Mm. But now, instead they get makos then?
Yes. That's the assumption. There's a little bit of discussion among the Rishonim, but the assumption is that they would get makos. Now, there is a question about, wait a minute, shouldn't they have to pay? Because when it's not just kofar, the defendant would have paid, his ox was going to get killed also. So shouldn't they have to pay for the ox that they falsely accused poor old Bessie of killing someone? She would never kill anybody, but that's what they falsely accused the ox of doing. So shouldn't they owe the owner money in lieu of the ox that would have been put to death by Beis Din? That's a monetary compensation. So the Meiri actually says, yeah, that's what they would pay. And seemingly that might even be in lieu of makos. But that's a footnote. The assumption is that they get makos instead of paying kofar. In all these cases, they get makos as a default punishment. Now, the Gemara is going to take a little bit of a tangent, so just hang on over here. We won't spend that much time on it, but we'll try to make our way through it and understand it to the best that we can. So, Mantana Kufra Kapara. There's a machlokes. Who says that kofar payment is for an atonement? According to some, it actually is a monetary compensation. So this whole exception is predicated on the assumption that when someone pays kofar, it's to achieve an atonement. It's not categorized as compensation. So who's the Tana? Who is the rabbi that we attribute this opinion to, that kufra kapara, that kofar payment is to achieve an atonement? Arachista, Rabbi Shmuel ben Oshel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka. It's Rabbi Shmuel ben Oshel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka. The Tanya, as we taught in another brisa, benosan pidyon nafsho, that he has to give in place of his soul. He has to give what's the right word for that? Someone help me out over here. Right. Good translation for pidyon.
Ransom?
Ransom, something like that. But he basically gives money in place of his life.
Redeem.
What was that?
Redeem?
Redemption. Yeah, redeem. Like pidyon haben. Right? So this is a redemption. He's redeeming his soul by paying the money. Really, he should be put to death also, just like the ox. But he gets to pay kofar. He gets to pay the kofar money instead to get himself out of it. So
pretty isn't sweet, the actually. Kofar money computed the amount of payment by the value of the loss that was caused?
Ah, very good. So that's exactly what we're going to jump into right now, this next section. So according to the first opinion, the Brisa, so what exactly are we paying for? Is it Domain Nizik or Domain Mazik? Is it computed? So my grandfather is pointing out, is it based off the person who purportedly, the person who was killed by the ox, or is it computed based on the mazik, the owner of the ox? Now, why would I be compelled to say one way or the other? That'd be based on the worth of the owner of the ox or the worth of the person who was killed by the ox. So Rabbi Shmuel ben Oshel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka omer demei mazik, based off the mazik. Now, my laba kamiflagi, what's the basis for their disagreement? The mar savar kufra mamona, mar savar kufra kapara. Ah, what's the base of their dispute? Those who compute based off the worth of the owner of the ox, they understand that it's the kapara. So it's an atonement. Since really the owner should be killed, he's paying instead of his life. So therefore it makes sense. It's based on how much he is worth. But if it's a compensation for the person who was murdered, then it should be computed based on the worth of the person who was killed by the ox. That would be a very reasonable way to explain that machlokas. However,
how can you come up with an amount for the value of a person?
So this is not something we do nowadays, I'm sure you're aware. But back in the day, they had
debts on the slave market.
Yes, so Toby is correct. So back in the day, they had slave markets. So in theory, if this person were to be sold on the slave market, they would assess how much he would have been worth on that slave market, and that's how much the compensation is.
Wow.
Correct. So, Amara Papa, but there's a second way to understand it. Lo, dekuliyama kuver kapara. No, really, according to everybody, it's a kapara. Everyone holds the kofar payment is a kapara. Just their argument, everyone agrees in principle, it's an atonement for the owner of the ox. The question just is a technical question of, well, okay, but now do we base it on him or do we base it on the person who got killed? So my tanaya de rabbanan, but wait a minute, what's the logic? Once we say it's an atonement for the owner of the ox, then it should be the worth of the owner. What's the logic of the rabbanan to say that it should be based off the person who was killed? If it's supposed to be a kapara. So the answer is nemar hashaslamat of nemar hashaslamat. Malalam b'dinizik, afkan b'dinizik. So the answer is that it says in the case of, we dealt with this, so those who were in the Sunday morning Chumash class, we had this case, that when, I think, we may have had it, I might be misremembering, but two people get into a fight, and then one of them accidentally hits a pregnant woman, thereby causing her to miscarry the fetus. So then he has to pay. And in that case there, it's based off the worth of the nizik, based off the loss of the fetus, not based off how much he is worth. So since the Gemara is called a Gezeira Shava, when similar language is used, unique language is used in two different areas of the Torah, it's to teach us that there is an analogy in the laws as well. So just like in that case over there that uses the language of hashasa, of yushas alav, and when it comes to the case of causing someone to miscarry, God forbid, then it's based on the nizik, based on the person who was damaged. Therefore, so too over here, it's based off the person who is damaged. It's based on the person who was killed by the ox, even though it's really an atonement for the person who's damaging the person. I'll take questions in a moment. Let me just wrap up this section. I've Rabbi Yishmael. So this is a very compelling proof. So why is Rabbi Yishmael based it off the damager? So the answer is Vinasam Pidyo Nafshoksiv. It says he should give a redemption for his soul, for the mazik, not for the person that was murdered because of his animal. So Rabbanon, and now what did the rabbi say to that? Ein pidyo in pidyo nafshoksiv, miyoki shaminam b'denizik shaminam. Even though it says that it's redemption for his soul, still it's based on the person who was killed, not based on the person who is seeking the atonement. Again, this section is like a little bit packed. We don't have as much time to elaborate on it, but I'll take if there's any questions for clarification, let me just take that. If anything was unclear, that could clarify. Okay. So let's get to the last cases. If anyone has any questions, because I want to just try to finish by 8:30 if possible. So I'll stay on though a few minutes afterwards to take any questions that people might have. I just want to be sensitive to everyone's time. Okay. Now that was exception number three. Exception number four, Vainim Karm Be'Evid Ivri. Why do the witnesses not get sold into servitude? Just like this person who they're accusing, the defendant would have been sold into servitude. So Sarav Hamnun Lamar, Hanimi Lehika the Islay Day, the meaning of the Ihu Lo Nizdavin, Inhu Nami Lo Mizdavinu. So what's the case that they don't get sold into slavery when the defendant would have had enough money that if he actually did have to pay the money in the end, he could have afforded it and he wouldn't have been sold into slavery. But if he did not have the funds, if he would have been sold into slavery, then yeah, actually, this isn't a full force exception. There are some times that the witnesses will be sold into slavery. There are sometimes the witnesses will not be sold into slavery. And it's all based on what would have happened to the defendant. Because again, they're getting the same din. They're getting the same verdict that the defendant would have had. Amarle Rava, but Rava challenges this. Velamerle iant havalach mi hava mizdavant anonami lo mizdavinan. The witnesses, so let's say the defendant doesn't have the funds, but the witnesses are well off. So the witnesses say, look, if you had the money, you wouldn't have been sold into servitude. We happen to have the money, so we get the same chance that you get. That's a very reasonable claim because, again, they're getting the same din. They're getting the same status as the defendant. The defendant's status is if he has the money, he doesn't get sold. So they, the witnesses, now take on his status. So if they have the money, they shouldn't be sold either. So that's Rava's counterclaim. So therefore, Rav Hamnuna adjusts his position. He says, El Sava Rav Hamnuna Lamemar Hani Milaheka de Isle Olidide Olididhu. So only in a case where neither the defendant nor the witnesses have enough money, only in that one scenario will the witnesses actually be sold into servitude. But if the defendant would have had enough money, or if the witnesses have enough money, then they do not get sold into servitude. So according to Rav Hamnuna, this is usually an exception to the rule. Usually the witnesses don't get sold in slavery and they get Malkus. But in this case, this is an exception if either parties would have had enough money. However, Rava disagrees. Amar le Rava, v'nimkar b'gnei vaso, amar achmana. B'gnei vaso v'lo b'zomimo. Very similar to what we saw before with going into exile, with not becoming disqualified Kohanim. It really just comes down to a diuk from a derivation from the verse. It says, Bigneva so, he should be sold in his theft that he committed, avalo bezamimo, but not in conspiring. So when someone steals, they don't have enough money and they get sold in servitude because they don't have enough money to pay off after they steal from somebody else. Only they get sold into servitude, not people who conspired against him to accuse him, trying to put him into servitude. So it really just comes down to Gezeira Shava. It comes down to, sorry, not Gezeira Shava. It comes down to Gezeira Sakasav. It comes down to what the verse tells us. That's the end. That's the explanation for why witnesses do not get sold into slavery. One more little exception, and then we will pause. If anyone needs to log off, you can, but this will take about just 1 to 2 minutes. Rabbi Akiva mentioned that witnesses who admit to committing, to being Edom Zomim, if they run to another court, the other court will not charge them for being Edom Zomim. So it's a pretty neat trick. They basically get accused in one court, then they run to the other court and they say, we committed the crime of being Edom Zomim. And then they get let off the hook in that second court.
Like being extradited.
Very good. So we'll talk about that in a moment, extradition. The Ksos HaChoshen talks about that. Good point. So Rabbi Akiva said, okay, so my time with Rabbi Akiva. That's very odd. Why can I, if I owe Shimon money and I go to court and I admit to owing Shimon money, if anything, that's just more reason for me to pay Shimon money, not less reason, right? So why do they get let off the hook for admitting to being in Zomen in another court? My time with Rekiva, Ksavar Knosahu, the Knas, Imisham Piyatsum. Ah, Rekiva understands when Edom Zomim get the punishment, it's viewed as a Knas, as a penalty, because they have to pay that which they tried to do to somebody else. So it's a great deterrent, meaning if you're not ready to risk getting executed yourself, don't try falsely accusing someone being executed. If you're not ready to pay a huge sum of money yourself, don't falsely accuse someone of owing money to somebody else. And the rule is, let's say I steal from you, so I owe kafel. I have to pay $200, not just $100, twice the principal amount. So if I admit in court before I'm found guilty that I stole from you, I only pay $100. I don't have to pay kafel. I don't have to pay $200. Why? Because it's a knas. When you admit to a knas, when you admit to a penalty, you absolve yourself of it, right? Wouldn't that be great for like parking tickets or things? You just come in and say, yeah, I accidentally parked there the other day, but absolve me from it. Doesn't work so well.
So then, Amar Rabba, let's
just finish this section if possible. Amar Rabba, Teda Shari, Lo Asu Maisa, Nehargim Umishalman. Now, how do we know? Wait, where are you coming up with this? How do we know that being a false witness, that getting punished for being Edom Zomim is a knas, a penalty? The answer is because here's the telltale sign. They didn't do a maisa. Meaning, if I stole from you, I did an action. I stole from you, I have to compensate you. The witnesses here, they didn't accomplish anything. They didn't even succeed in having Reuven pay Shimon. They only conspired. to have Reuven pay Shimon based on their false testimony. So that's how we know that what we're dealing with here is a penalty. It's a knas. It's not compensatory payment. Amar Rav Nachman, Tehashari Mamun B'Yad Bayal Mishalman. And how do we know that's a knas? Because the money still remains in the hands of Reuven. It never left Reuven's hands and went to Shimon's hands. That's how we know that what we're dealing with here is a penalty, is a knas, because the money doesn't need to leave Reuven's hands in order for the Edom Zoman to be found guilty. So now we say, Rav Nachman sounds like he's giving the same reason as Rabbah. So the excellent thing is, Rav Nachman agrees with Rabbah, he's just formulating it in a different way. But the reason someone doesn't get punished, the witnesses do not have to pay if they go to the second court, is because the punishment, the money that they're paying, is a penalty. And when you admit to a penalty in a court, you absolve yourself from the penalty. Now, Phyllis said, wait, so they're only putter in the second court. Could they be extradited to the first court? And the answer probably is yes. The Ketzos HaChoshen is bothered by the question that might be troubling us. Wait a minute, it's like you could just run away and then admit in a second court. You get away with Adam Zov, with Hazama all the time. So if they get extradited to the first court, they will still be held guilty in the first court, and the first court will be able to charge them as Adam Zovman, as they ruled originally. So Yasher Koach Phyllis, that's the Ketzos HaChoshen's point.
Is all there right. like an offset for what they just did in the second court, though?
Are they what?
Otherwise, it punished twice, right?
Right, right. Once they're, you know, they're punished, but they're really hoping they won't be extradited. You know, they went to like a Jewish court in somewhere in Europe. They're hiding away over there. So I don't know. It's funny. I want, you know, it'd be interesting if someone looked into how extradition worked back then. I'm not really sure how that worked.
If they stay in the first court and admit that they lied, do they get the double punishment?
What's the case?
Well, they're in the first court where they lied. Yeah. And then before they're found guilty of lying, they say, wait, we admit we lied. We didn't tell the truth.
So then what they would probably get, I think they would still get Malkus then. So here's the thing. It depends on what point in time. If the verdict was already given.
Before the verdict.
Oh, sorry, not before the verdict, and then they already gave false testimony, right?
Yeah.
So I think they would still get Malkus, if I'm not mistaken. I think they would still get lashes for it. But they wouldn't
That would make sense, because the whole scheme here is to try to maintain the integrity of the judicial system. Mm-hmm. It's not just a question of making right between the parties. It's also trying to maintain the integrity of the system. So even if you come in and you admit it in the nick of time, you've caused a lot of trouble.
And yeah, we gotta slap you with something.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought last time there was we talked about this, that you can only become a conspiring witness after the Beit Din had ruled, but before the punishment was carried out. So if they come in ahead of time before there's a ruling, there hasn't been.
So case over here, the timeline is important. Very, very good point, Jenny. The timeline here is that there was a verdict given. There was Gemar Din, and the witnesses actually were accused. The second pair came in and established that they were false witnesses. But apparently, security wasn't so good that day. They slipped out and they ran to the next court, and that's how they got away. So,
that's why you said the timeline is important.
What?
That's why you said the timeline is important.
Exactly.
In the beginning, you said that. Important.
Okay. I have some more things to share. I'll share them at the beginning of next time. I want to end now. But Yashko, thank you for staying on a few extra minutes. And we just finished a full daf of Gemara, and we only have 22 left. So.
Kal vachomer, you could say logically.
Okay. I'll work on it, Phyllis. Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. Yashko.
Good night.